Chapter 4, Modern Monetary Theory, A Fuel for a Global Economic Takeover. And I sincerely believe with you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, and that the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale. Thomas Jefferson, in a letter to John Taylor, May 28, 1816. In 1910, U.S. Senator Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island, the chairman of the National Monetary Committee, instructed several of America's highest-profile bankers to covertly meet at night in a train station in New Jersey. Among those who attended were Henry P. Davidson, senior partner at J.P. Morgan and Company, Paul Warburg, founder of the investment firm Kuhn, Loeb, and Company, Frank A. Vanderclip, he was the vice president of the National City Bank of New York, now called Citibank, and Charles D. Norton, president of Morgan's First National Bank of New York. These wealthy, extremely well-connected men, selected by Aldrich, one of the most powerful senators of his day, were told that they must hide their identities, use only first names with each other, and dress as if they were going on a duck hunting expedition. You know, because late night duck hunting train rides are not suspicious at all. The bankers were then informed that they would be heading to a lavish resort in Georgia on Jekyll Island, where they would join other important businessmen, policymakers, to formulate a plan to reshape America's banking system. Once they arrived at Jekyll Island, hidden under the fog of secrecy, these members of America's economic elite began crafting legislation that would eventually become the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. It's the law that created the Federal Reserve Bank, the central banking structure of the United States, a system that has controlled U.S. monetary policy for more than 100 years, was created by a real-life honest-to-goodness conspiracy. The meeting at Jekyll Island was not the first time powerful bankers and government officials attempted to create a central bank. Two other prominent efforts were made to establish a central bank in the United States prior to the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. Both were short-lived. What made the third attempt successful? And what can we learn from this important moment in history? Well, after the panic of 1907, the economy of the United States was, to say the least, rattled. Unemployment was high, the banking system was on the verge of collapse, and the panic was just the latest in a series of recessions that shook the U.S. financial markets, prompting politicians and bankers to come up with a big government solution to deal with past and future economic upheavals, one that would provide for even greater influence to ruling class elites. Does any of this sound familiar? By 1910, increased interest in solving the perceived banking crisis developed among many of the authoritative people on Wall Street. In November 1910, the Academy of Political Science at Columbia University, the New York Chamber of Commerce, and the Merchants Association of New York hosted a conference to formulate potential answers to the questions that had been plaguing bankers for decades. Economists, policy analysts, and many high-level representatives from the nation's largest banks took part in the meeting, and according to attendees, it was at this conference, one almost no one in America knows about today, that the real groundwork was laid for the nation's new central bank. At the end of the conference, attendees were told to spread the word and convince the American people of the need for the radical overhaul outlined there. Christopher Stewart Patterson, dean of the University of Pennsylvania and member of the Indianapolis Monetary Commission, told those who attended the meeting, quote, "That is just what you must do in this case. You must uphold the hands of Senator Aldrich. You have got to see that the bill which he formulates obtains the support of every part of this country." Shortly after the conference, Senator Aldrich orchestrated the meeting at Jekyll Island to develop specific legislative language for developing a new central bank, and the rest is history. The secret meetings that occurred in 1910 were not organized by globalist European elites, but they do have special relevance to the Great Reset and the topic of this chapter, modern monetary theory. Had the Federal Reserve never been created, the 21st century fascism of the Great Reset would be virtually impossible to achieve, because without central banks churning out trillions of new dollars, how could government elites pay for all of their shiny new socialist programs? Perhaps even more important, the events of 1910 teach us that a relatively small group of elites can and do make gargantuan, history-changing alterations to global economic markets, and they can do so without most people really even understanding the repercussions of their actions or even knowing that they've occurred. I am certainly not suggesting that important decisions are made at every or even most academic conferences, but once in a while, a conference of people so powerful takes place and the world suddenly changes. It's a fact worth remembering as the Great Reset Movement plans its next great conference of influencers in 2022. The big question. Millions of Americans face many problems: poor education, joblessness, homelessness, and a lack of affordable health care, just to name a few. There is no shortage of things that could be better, and ruling class elites have absolutely no shortage of supposed solutions to these problems. Free college, universal basic income, government housing, and government-run health care. You name it, and politicians from both political parties want to provide it, and often it's free. The confounding question inevitably arises, how are we going to pay for this? This is the question that probably used to keep elites in Washington up at night, stalking their dreams like Freddy Krueger. One minute they're fantasizing about a world powered by billions of solar panels, and then, out of nowhere, someone sporting a bladed glove asks about paying for things, waking the politicians, lobbyists, and solar power business executives from their Great Reset slumber. In the past, policy proposals would be rejected frequently because they were considered too expensive. To fund their pet projects, lawmakers routinely would have to search for what congressional insiders called pay-fors, which often come in the shape of new taxes or increases to existing tax rates. Political candidates would cobble together these schemes for how they could theoretically fund all the programs they promised to pass if elected. This boogeyman struck the deep blue state of Vermont in 2014. Soon after passing a state-level universal health care plan, the then-governor, Peter Shumlin, was distraught to find his team had failed to craft a realistic plan to pay for the ambitious project. Turned out that any state plan to fund the government-run health care system would have required massive tax increases that would have put the state, quote, at risk of economic shock, end quote. Shumlin was eventually forced to abandon the planned universal health care program, a move he called, quote, the greatest disappointment of my political life so far, end quote. Shumlin's single-payer health care debacle shows just how powerful the how are you going to pay for it question has been in U.S. politics, even recently. This single-payer program failed in Bernie Sanders' home state of Vermont, perhaps the most liberal state in America. Even though there was plenty of political demand for government-run health care, and a governor who campaigned and won his election by promising to enact a plan just like it. Yet Green Mountain Care still went belly up because no one could figure out how to pay for it. Even on a national level, massive price tags have rendered countless proposals dead on arrival in recent years. One of the most notable examples is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal. This monster of a plan included a wish list for many on the left, including 100% renewable energy, universal health care, a federal jobs guarantee, and college debt cancellation. But like Shumlin's single-payer health care dreams, the Green New Deal was murdered by sticker shock. Even many Democrats ended up rejecting the proposal because of its high expenses. The Green New Deal non-binding resolution failed to earn a single vote in the U.S. Senate, and it was never approved by the Democrat-led House of Representatives. The American Action Forum, AAF, ran the numbers on the Green New Deal. When all is said and done, AAF determined that Ocasio-Cortez's plan would cost upward of $94 trillion in just 10 years. That is the equivalent of cutting every single American a check to the tune of $280,000. I don't know about you, but I think I'm going for what's behind door number two, Monty. Again, think about the power of asking, how are you going to pay for it? The Green New Deal did not die in the democratically controlled House because of its more unpopular provisions. It was also not because of the economic harm that would result from enacting the plan in states like Pennsylvania and Colorado, nor the environmental destruction that comes along with relying completely on energy sources like wind and solar, which we unpacked in the previous chapter. No, it was the $94 trillion number that dominated the headlines. The plan was so expensive that Nancy Pelosi even stopped supporting it. Now, that is really saying something. Why is the pay-for-it question so politically important? The answer is probably obvious to most of the people reading this book because money and resources are scarce. We have a limited supply of wealth, a limited supply of labor and time, which makes all of those things valuable. This is the basic truth that is pervasive in economics and even part of the definition. As Investopedia puts it, quote, economics is the study of how people allocate scarce resources for production, distribution, and consumption, both individually and collectively, end quote. Scarcity is the cornerstone upon which everything else in economics is built. Fundamental principles like supply and demand, price signals, and opportunity costs are all anchored to this one core concept, scarcity. Dealing with scarcity has always been a gigantic problem for elites in the Democrat and Republican parties looking to use government to build massive new programs. How can they possibly overcome this economic obstacle? Well, they could raise taxes on the middle and upper classes, but that works only to an extent. Eventually, people feel taxed enough already, and they don their tri-corner hats and throw politicians out of power. Of course, policymakers could tax the rich, but that eventually fails too, as wealthy people find ways to stash their cash overseas and or move businesses out of high-tax regions. Sometimes governments simply resort to force. They can't figure out a good way of taxing people, so they just steal property. They nationalize industries, even throw people in prison. Although that option has always been on the table, the advent of the 24-hour cable news cycle really makes full-blown persecution more difficult than it used to be. Don't you miss the good old days when dictators could just mass murder people without news crews getting in the way? Oh, we're headed in that direction again, believe me. To advance programs that centralize power in the hands of the ruling class while winning over Main Street Americans, elites needed something stronger than tax increases, but not overtly authoritarian, like gulags. And they found their answer in the allure of modern monetary theory, MMT. MMT has already been adopted by governments all over the world, although you'll not find leaders spending much time talking about it. And it is currently an important part of the strategy that supporters of the Great Reset are using to help usher in their transformation of the global economy. Modern monetary theory. My first real taste of modern monetary theory came in a March 2019 town hall event on education policy in Brooklyn, New York. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, took the stage to espouse the merits of increasing educational opportunities for more people in the city. A constituent in the crowd then began to raise his or her voice. It's hard to make out what the heckler was saying, but you can bet it's a version of the big question discussed in the previous section. AOC's shouting response was revealing. My concern that this right here, where we're fighting each other, is exactly what happens under a scarcity mindset, end quote. In the minds of AOC and a growing number of other politicians in Washington, D.C., humans have essentially reached a post-scarcity world. We can have anything we want, and more, if we just exert our political wills hard enough. In this worldview, the how are you going to pay for it question is outdated. It belongs in the dustbin of history alongside with the horse and buggy and the Constitution. Instead of paying for things, policymakers should dig up traditional economic cornerstones and cast them aside in favor of nearly unlimited government spending. Now, some, including me early on, might be tempted to write off AOC's views on government spending and scarcity as incredibly uncommon and thus not worth serious consideration or concern. However, there is an entire movement of academics who champion this new way of looking at scarcity as it relates to monetary policy, the modern monetary theory movement. Although its membership remains relatively small, it has had, because of the important implications of its beliefs, a tremendous and far-reaching impact on public policy just in the last few years. Currently, the face of modern monetary theory is Stephanie Kelton. She's a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. Kelton is about as well-connected as an economist can be. In 2015, she served as the chief economist of the Democratic Party's staff on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. Kelton was also senior economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 and 2020 presidential campaigns, and a member of Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders' 2020 Unity Task Force, which was given the responsibility of reforming the platform of the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party. Additionally, Kelton is the author of the popular new MMT book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory, and the Birth of the People's Economy. More on Kelton's book later. By the way, if you're listening to the audiobook, we are now at footnote 217. Don't take my word for any of these things. Get the hard copy. Look up the footnotes yourself. It's important that you know the facts and what's coming from the original source. Other notable MMT economists include L. Randall Ray, a professor of economics at Bard College, and Pavlina Cherneva, a program director and associate professor of economics at Bard College, and research associate at Levy Economics Institute. If you read my previous book, Arguing with Socialists, some of this might sound familiar to you, but stick with me because there's plenty of new information in this chapter to keep this refresher course a little entertaining, enlightening, and very important. Modern monetary theory might sound complicated, but it's actually very, very simple. According to MMT theorists, everybody should stop worrying so much about the national debt and deficits because the U.S. government can print and spend as much money as it wants in order to achieve the goals set by the federal government's bureaucratic masterminds and political elite. That's pretty much it. When most people first hear about modern monetary theory, they usually say something like, "That's a bunch of malarkey." Actually, no one under the age of 1,000 says malarkey. Sorry, Joe Biden. But you get the idea. As with many other concepts I'm going to discuss throughout this book, try to avoid dismissing MMT as a crackpot theory that no reasonable person would ever try to implement. I lost 3 years of research doing just that on this topic. MMT is appealing to many because of its potential to dramatically increase the power of government and fatten the pockets of the corporate class, not because it's supported by history or because of its academic merits. Also, as I'm sure you already know, politicians and bureaucrats are often anything but reasonable. How MMT works. It is hard to ignore election season. there is a steady stream of the political ads on every television and every radio station, candidate lawn signs that pop up and never seem to be taken down on time, and heated shouting matches at family gatherings. No, you're the racist, Uncle Ned! Ah, politics. Isn't it fun? In addition to all the screaming and terrible campaign ads, election season is also a time when Americans are reminded about how the U.S. national debt and annual deficits have grown out of control. Even Barack Obama positioned himself at first as a fiscal hawk when campaigning in 2008. During one stop in Fargo, North Dakota, then-candidate Obama complained that the spending practices of President George W. Bush's administration, which had added $4 trillion to the national debt over Bush's two terms in office, were so out of hand that they had become, quote, unpatriotic. I guess that makes the multi-trillion dollar deficits of 2020 look like an act of economic terrorism. As strange as it might sound, supporters of modern monetary theory have criticized Obama for pointing out George W. Bush's spending problems and even suggested that one of Obama's biggest mistakes as president was not spending enough money. Yeah, look it up. Footnotes here. You read that correctly. According to MMT, Barack Obama, the man who presided over the largest addition to the national debt in history prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, should have spent trillions more following the 2008 financial crash, and he shouldn't have lost a wink of sleep over it. Under modern monetary theory, because the United States is a currency issuer, there is no danger that the country will ever become insolvent. The federal government has a monopoly on dollar production, money printing, so it can't run out of money. Thus, MMT advocates say if we need more cash, all the government has to do is turn on the printing presses, or more accurately, move numbers around on an electronic spreadsheet. Years ago, this is where and why I dismissed MMT. Huge mistake. In a 2019 interview with CNBC, Kelton explained this idea more completely, highlighting the distinction between a money user and a money issuer. Quote, MMT starts with a really simple observation, and that is that the U.S. dollar is a simple public monopoly. In other words, the United States currency comes from the United States government. It can't come from anywhere else, and therefore, it can never run out of money. It cannot face a solvency problem. Bills are coming due that it can't afford to pay. Well, it never has to worry about finding the money in order to be able to spend. It doesn't need to go and raise taxes or borrow money before it's able to spend. So what that means is that the federal government is nothing like a household. In order for a household or a private business to be able to spend, they have to come up with the money, right? And the federal government doesn't have to behave like a household. In fact, it becomes really destructive for the economy if the federal government tries to behave like a household. You and I are using U.S. dollars. States and municipalities, the state of Kansas or city of Detroit, they're also using the U.S. dollar. Private businesses are using the dollar. The federal government in the United States is issuing our currency. And so we have a very different relationship to the currency. That means in order to spend, the government doesn't have to do what a household or private business has to do. Find the money. The government can just simply spend the money into the economy, and when it does, the rest of us end up receiving that spending as part of our income. According to Kelton, the federal government doesn't have to behave like a household, as we've all been told for years by countless politicians, including President Barack Obama. They have all gotten it wrong, under Kelton's theory. The Federal Reserve, under this theory, should effectively give the government a hall pass to spend as much money as it wants. Doesn't that sound great? Free ponies for everybody. Scratch that. Make it 2 pony. Hell, I'm feeling generous. 12 ponies for every child. You're probably wondering, but what about the national debt? The U.S. debt has already surpassed $28 trillion as of this printing. And at this rate, it could be a quadrillion by the time the book actually is in its third printing. Won't that have some serious long-term consequences for the economy? Fret not, Kelton says. The national debt's just a number. Quote, let's remember what the national debt is, Kelton said in an interview with CNBC. The national debt is nothing more than a historic record of all the dollars that the government spent into the economy and didn't tax back that they're currently being held in the form of safe U.S. treasuries. End quote. Under MMT, debt and deficits are nothing to fear. They are encouraged. Listen to Kelton explain. Quote, normally, I think people tend to hear deficit and think it's something that we should strive to eliminate, that we shouldn't be running budget deficits, that they're evidence of fiscal irresponsibility. And the truth is, the deficit can be too big. Evidence a deficit's too big would be inflation. But the deficit can also be too small. It can be too small to support demand in the economy, and evidence of a deficit that is too small is unemployment. So deficits can be too big, but they can be too small. And then there's a level that's just right, said Goldilocks. She continues, and the right level of the deficit is the one that gets you a balanced overall economy, the one that allows you to achieve high levels of employment and low inflation, end quote. So as Kelton noted, modern monetary theory supporters believe deficit spending should be used to reach full employment. But that's not where deficit spending should end. MMTers say it should also be used to achieve every other goal elites have for society. In a 2019 article for Barron's, writer Matthew Klein compared MMT to a, quote, peacetime version of wartime economic management, end quote. And he suggested MMTers believe, quote, governments can do whatever is necessary to satisfy the public purpose as long as they maintain their authority over the populace. Wow, is that an important concept? Footnote 223. Just imagine all of the things the government could do if it was not limited by that looming big question. Should we cancel all the student loan debt, no matter how rich the borrower is? Why not? Debt and deficits don't matter. Should we pass $94 trillion Green New Deal? Why not? Debt and deficits don't matter. Should we continue to nation build all around the world? Why not? Deficits and debt don't matter. You see, modern monetary theory is the perfect tool for politicians who make grandiose promises without any plan to pay for them, which is just about every politician these days. So if you're just now hearing about all of this wild theory, you're likely to be thinking one or both of the following. First, if the government can just print money, why would it need to tax anyone? Two, wouldn't all this massive money printing result in inflation? Good questions, hypothetical reader. Let's address them one at a time. Taxation under MMT. Under a standard economic model, which is to say reality, governments and politicians are generally constrained by limited tax revenue. Now, I say generally because yearly deficits and growing national debt are proof the government is rarely able to live within its means. To initiate a new spending program, politicians are now required to figure out the answer of the big question we've been discussing throughout this chapter. How are you going to pay for it? This requirement forces politicians to walk through the political minefield of revenue generation schemes. Maybe we can raise taxes on businesses. Boom! The higher unemployment mine goes off. How about we raise taxes on sugary drinks? Bang! The constituent anger mine explodes. Perhaps we could just issue an extra 39-cent tax on every gallon of gasoline. Kapow! The yellow vest protest mind bursts. This trek through the political how-will-you-pay-for-it minefield is never fun for any politician. They are usually, typically, interested in doing whatever it takes to keep voters happy so they can win more elections in the future. The sole reason most politicians wake up in the morning. But under MMT, taxes serve a very different purpose. Instead of being used to raise revenues to pay for government spending programs, they function as tools that help government manage the economy more closely and as weapons to punish those businesses, groups, and people that government does not like for whatever reason. This is all made very clear in Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth. In Chapter 1, Kelton outlines four ways in which taxation can be used under a modern monetary theory system. 1. Use our currency, or else. According to Kelton, the first reason government should continue using taxes under modern monetary theory is that, quote, taxes enable governments to provision themselves without the use of explicit force, end quote. Or to put it another way, they just require people to use dollars instead of any other kind of currency. In Kelton's world, people must be pushed into using her freshly printed government-issued monopoly money, not nearly persuaded in God we trust sort of ways. Alternative currencies, now we're talking cryptocurrencies, cannot be tolerated as a payment for taxes owed. Government and big banks can create all the money they want, but if no one uses or demands those pieces of paper decorated with founding fathers and government buildings, then that paper becomes useless, and elites will lose their power to control monetary policy. This is an unacceptable scenario from the perspective of those who support MMT. In the past, the idea was there could never be an America in which there's widespread use of an alternative currency. It seemed too far-fetched for most people to consider. But technological advancements have made new currencies possible in a way that generations before us never dreamt of. Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, Chainlink, they are all part of decentralized networks and not commissioned by any government. Yet they have become increasingly popular over the past decade as millions of people have started to question the long-term stability of the In God We Trust dollar. The value of these digital currencies, they're based solely on the popularity of the currency and the blockchain technology on which each is based. Bitcoin, for example, cannot print more units of its currency, making it attractive for many people concerned about the government's addiction to debt and deficits. Of course, America is hardly on the verge of adopting Bitcoin as its primary currency. The point is, the use of cryptocurrencies has expanded in recent years, especially with the rise of e-commerce, and it's only more likely to continue to expand in the years to come. For Stephanie Kelton and other MMTers, cryptocurrencies represent a threat to the power of the government and bankers. Taxation is a surefire way to guarantee that the dollar remains in use. What better way to force someone to use the dollar than to charge that person a tax that is payable only with government-printed currency? 2. Inflation control. The most common knee-jerk reaction to MMT is the fear that it will cause unsustainable amounts of harmful inflation. Reasonable people are concerned that if government, with the backing of financial institutions, gets into the habit of just running the printing presses whenever it wants the money, which is pretty much all the time, we will soon end up with Zimbabwe levels of inflation. Admittedly, modern monetary theorists do spend a lot of time thinking and worrying about inflation. It is probably the thing the academic wing of the MMT movement is most concerned with. So how then do they propose avoiding inflation while simultaneously printing trillions of new dollars? Kelton also explains this in her book, that according to MMT, inflation is the warning sign of overspending, not deficits. Remember, in modern monetary theory, deficits are almost always a good thing. Deficit spending ensures that the economy is running at full steam, properly using its available resources and leaving no potential workers on the sidelines. If there is a single willing worker sitting idly by without a job opportunity, modern monetary theory supporters would argue that the government is not spending enough money, regardless of how much cash is already in the printing. This does not mean that government officials could wake up tomorrow morning and print $50 trillion, though. It is possible to spend too much cash in modern monetary theory. It occurs when the private sector entities and the governments are both vying for limited resources, and too much money is chasing too few goods and services in one or several parts of an economy. If inflation occurs, how should the government deal with this problem? Reduce government spending? No, of course not. Instead, Kelton suggests raising taxes to force us to cut back a little to make room for the additional government spending. End quote. Kelton further argues, quote, if the government wants to boost spending on healthcare and education, it may need to remove some spending power from the rest of us to prevent its own even more generous outlays from pushing up prices. Footnote 228. Stop for a moment. Think about what this highly influential economist is suggesting. Under modern monetary theory, the government might need to battle inflation by destroying the wealth of the people, including the middle and working classes, in order to make room for more government spending. Wow, I guess that whole free lunch thing really is a myth after all. There is a lot more I could say about the specter of inflation and policy prescriptions modern monetary theorists have proposed to avoid it, but we'll get to that shortly. For now, I want to go back to our list. 3, wealth redistribution. As I've already shown at length, modern monetary theory gives the government a blank check to pay for all of the social programs it wants, from free college tuition to government-guaranteed job programs and 100% renewable energy. However, even if those programs were to work exactly as intended, and in my opinion, they will not and never do, social programs cannot, on their own, address wealth inequality. But where the government social programs fall short, modern monetary theorists say taxes fill in the gaps. Kelton wrote, quote, MMT sees taxes as an important means to help redress decades of rising inequality. End quote. According to Kelton and others, taxes can help reduce wealth inequality by confiscating wealth from those deemed too rich, theoretically balancing the scales. Some MMT academics take an even more radical view of the use of taxation. In fact, Professor L. Randall Ray wrote the following response in reaction to questions about how taxes relate to modern monetary theory. Quote, for far too long, left-leaning Democrats have had a close symbiotic relationship with the rich. They've needed the good rich folk like George Soros, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Bob Rubin, to fund their think tanks and political campaigns. The centrist Clinton wing has repaid the generosity of Wall Street's neoliberals with deregulation that allowed the CEOs to just shovel money to themselves, vastly increasing inequality and their own power. And they in turn rewarded Hillary, who by her own account accepted whatever money they would throw in her direction. Today's progressives won't fall into that trap. How are you going to pay for it? Through a budget authorization. Uncle Sam can afford it without the help of the rich. And by the way, they're going to tax you anyway, because you have too much income, too much wealth, too much power. What will we do with the tax revenue? Burn it? Uncle Sam doesn't need your money. In reality, taxes just lead to debits to bank accounts. We just knock 3 or 5 zeros off the accounts of the rich. Of course, double entry bookkeeping means we also need to knock zeros off the debts held by the rich. So we'll wipe zeros off student loan debts, mortgage debts, auto loan debts, credit card debts of American households. Yes, debt cancellation too, end quote. After many years of watching academics and corrupt politicians closely, I am rarely shocked, but I have to admit, when I first read this quote by L. Randall Ray, I was floored. It is worth looking at the most important part again. They're going to tax you anyway because you've got too much income, too much wealth, too much power. What will we do with the tax revenue? Burn it. Uncle Sam doesn't need your money, end quote. Well, Ray could not be possibly any clearer about how MMT economists plan to use taxes to punish those individuals and families who already have, quote, too much wealth, end quote, whatever that means. And what will they do with all the cash? Drench it with gasoline and light it on fire like the Joker in The Dark Knight, just with less face paint and fewer henchmen dressed up as clowns? Under MMT, the government does not need tax revenue. All it needs is power. Power over its own currency. Pavlina Cherneva, a professor at economics at Bard College and research associate at the Levy Economics Institute, has repeated many of the same arguments put forward by Ray and Kelton, referring to those foolish liberals concerned about generating tax revenue as tax the rich to pay for progress lefties, as she argued that relying on taxing the rich is a, quote, imaginary umbilical cord that holds the progressive agenda hostage to the oppressors, end quote. To me, Cherneva wrote, this is the definition of a self-induced paralysis, end quote. 4. Control of society. Imagine you're on your way home from work and you're driving a little faster than usual because, well, you've had one too many Diet Cokes and you foolishly left the office without using the restroom. Of course, today is your unlucky day. A local police officer catches you driving 37 in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, and before you know it, you're back on your way home with a new passenger in the seat beside you, a $120 speeding ticket. Fines like these exist as deterrents to unwanted or unsafe behaviors. Society, through its elected representatives, have determined that speed limits are needed for protecting other drivers on the road, and police officers have been tasked with ensuring that people follow the law. Speed limits might be annoying or unnecessarily strict at times, but most Americans agree that they do serve an important purpose. Now, of course, every driver also knows that in addition to acting as a deterrent, speeding tickets also function as a vital revenue generator for local law enforcement. So, from some government's perspective, everyone's a winner when a driver receives a speeding ticket. The community is a little safer, and the government coffers are a little more secure. Over time, politicians stumbling through the political minefield of revenue generation schemes have realized that speeding tickets are not only the way to raise revenue while eliminating bad behaviors. Today's fines are issued for all sorts of sins, especially to punish those less sympathetic groups like cigarette smokers. Why not squeeze a few extra bucks out of them by levying a new tobacco tax? They shouldn't be smoking anyway, right? In many cases, governments have gone overboard, imposing a slew of excessive fines and sin taxes to help raise revenue for town, city, state, or federal government, all under the guise of promoting public health, safety, or some other allegedly noble cause. However, in a world dominated by modern monetary theory, there's no reason for governments to pass laws for the purpose of raising tax revenue. The federal government can simply print all the money it needs and then distribute it to state and local officials. So does that mean Kelton and other MMT supporters believe their system could lead to a reduction of fines and sin taxes? Oh no, of course not. As Kelton notes, under modern monetary theory, governments, quoting, can use taxes to encourage or discourage certain behaviors, to improve public health, to battle climate change, or deter risky speculation in financial markets. Footnote 233. So rather than disincentivizing government from imposing controls on society, a system utilizing modern monetary theory would empower policymakers to use the tax code to manipulate people, even if they no longer have a financially motivated reason to do so. Risk of inflation. Okay, now that you have a solid understanding of how taxes fit into modern monetary theory, let's turn to the big elephant in the room. How do modern monetary theorists plan to stop inflation? Traditionally, when policymakers float the idea of expanding the Federal Reserve's balance sheet or running the printing presses to find a new government program, those of us concerned about the national debt brace for the devaluation of our currency, commonly called inflation. In extreme cases, we are reminded of the recent rampant inflation in Venezuela in 2018 or stories from the 1920s Germany, where money became so worthless under the disastrous policies of the Weimar Republic that families wallpapered their homes literally with cash. In 2008, in Zimbabwe, hyperinflation caused by irresponsible money printing practices became so bad, inflation levels topped at 89.7 sextillion percent. This forced the government, which could barely function under these conditions, to issue bills with increasingly higher bill denominations. In 2009, Zimbabwe released a $100 trillion bill. It's the largest denomination ever printed. But hey, even though the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe made it difficult for families to put food on the table, at least everyone could become a trillionaire. Don't worry, America. MMTers swear that Zimbabwe's hyperinflation hell will just not happen here in the United States. I mean, this time it's different. To defend their position, they usually cite several key arguments. First, the U.S. dollar is a world reserve currency, which means countries across the globe use and accept the dollar when conducting trade, adding an extra level of stability that most other currencies do not enjoy. This one is important, so we're going to come back to it soon and discuss it further. Second, modern monetary theorists like L. Randall Ray argue that most of the worst examples of hyperinflation were brought on by very specific circumstances, such as civil war or huge external debts denominated in a foreign currency. The U.S. dollar's status as the world reserve currency defends against both of these threats, but especially the latter. Third, modern monetary theorists say there is no reason to worry about hyperinflation because Americans have access to the unstoppable weapon of monetary security, the Congressional Budget Office, CBO. And I am not joking. You can't make this stuff up. This is what Kelton said in 2019. Quote, "So the best defense against inflation is a good offense. And what MMT does is try to be kind of hypersensitive to the risks of inflation. I don't see any other macro school of thought pay as careful attention as we do to the inflation risk question. And so what we would say is, look, if you're Congress and you're considering a new spending bill, instead of thinking about the ways in which the new spending will add to the deficit or add to the debt, you should be thinking about the ways in which that the new spending has the risk of accelerating inflation, and then just avoid doing that." She continues, "So instead of going to the Congressional Budget Office and saying, we'd like you to take a look at this piece of legislation and give us feedback, we'd like to know what this bill would do to the debt and deficit over time, instead go to the Congressional Budget Office or other government agencies and say, we're considering passing this $1 trillion investment in infrastructure. This is our bill. Would you look at it? And we plan to do this spending over the course of the next 5 years. Tell us if that would create problems in the real economy. Evaluate the inflation risk and come back to us and give some feedback." Okay. Jeez. Can I take a break just before my head explodes? Kelton's preposterous answer to the inflation question is to have the fate of the world's largest economy rely on the predictions of the Congressional Budget Office. Are you kidding me? The CBO is the same dysfunctional agency that has been issuing a steady stream of false projections for decades. its projection for Obamacare in 2012, the enrollment was off a whopping 150%. For a monetary system that needs to be hypersensitive to the risks of inflation, putting all your eggs in the CBO's broken basket with no bottom in it seems like a catastrophically bad idea. Oh, but wait, it doesn't end there. Kelton also says that inflation can be prevented under MMT by vesting government with enough authority that it could micromanage the economy and thus control inflation. Quote, and so when you think about how to fight inflation, Kelton says, I think the first question to understand is what the source of the inflationary pressure is, and then move forward with a policy tool that you think is going to help you get at that inflation. If you've got inflation resulting from energy price increases, it's probably not going to do much to have the Fed raise interest rates or even have Congress raise taxes. You have to do something else that is going to work. End quote. This solution is the one that provides the real secret herbs and spices that make MMT such an important part of the plan to create 21st century fascism. Let's use Kelton's example of the energy market to illustrate this point. In Kelton's modern monetary theory fantasy, policymakers begin using freshly printed money to chase their goal of 100% renewable energy. Money begins to flow into politically connected companies that start producing big, beautiful new solar panels and wind turbines. Energy prices then start to increase. Well, this is deemed inflation. But the public has no reason to be concerned because the political elites, who are often barely functional human beings themselves to begin with, are given the green light to craft policy tools and use the tax code to fight against rising prices. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? Well, for starters, everything. Why should we believe that the same people who created this brand new inflation-causing energy system would be smart enough to fix the problem that they caused? Why didn't they just design the system to avoid inflation in the first place? And if government officials are so good at problem-solving and planning, why haven't they figured out a way to get Amtrak to turn a profit or the Postal Service to stop hemorrhaging billions of dollars every year? Further, does anyone really think politicians are going to cut off spending to well-connected renewable energy companies amid a transition to a world free of fossil fuels? Surely politicians would not put concerns about inflation before the existential threat of global warming. Right? In the end, Kelton's system would depend on a scapegoat to blame when everything goes horribly wrong. And in this case, it would be almost certainly fossil fuel companies who have in recent decades fallen out of favor with the ruling elites. It would not be hard to convince those in charge to give oil and gas companies the axe to help bring prices down after government's money printing effort drives them up. You can play these scenarios out in virtually every sector of the economy. Ultimately, trillions of new dollars created by the government would result in inflation, either in the economy as a whole or specific sectors. It would force bureaucrats then to selectively identify the sources of inflationary pressure and then craft policy tools to deal with those problems. It's a perfect plan for those trying to control society. But as for the rest of us, well, we're going to be left out in the cold, especially if the entire country is required to run on wind and solar. At present, elites at the Federal Reserve have essentially one major monetary lever left in the toolbox, the baseline interest rate. During periods of economic malaise, the Fed turns the dial and lowers the interest rates in an attempt to boost markets by infusing them with cash from lower interest loans. When inflation creeps in, the Fed then has to turn the dial in the other direction, raising interest rates to curb rising prices. This is what they did in 1913. Don't you love it? Modern monetary theory throws out the dial and replaces it with a gigantic control panel full of levers, knobs, and switches that allow bureaucrats to manage the economy and society as they see fit. Sounds a little like something from the people who are calling for the Great Reset of the global economy, doesn't it? Those calling for the Great Reset like the idea of modern monetary theory so much, they invited the face of MMT, Stephanie Kelton, to speak on behalf of the economic theory during a November 2020 World Economic Forum virtual event promoting the Great Reset. Footnote 241. During her segment, Kelton told the panel they need not worry about debt and deficits, and then she explained how MMT could be used to justify massive spending programs designed to transform society. Quote, governments can establish where it is they want to go, and they can provide the kind of large-scale and patient finance that can remain in place for the duration of the time we are going to be making transformative investments in our economy moving forward, end quote. Kelton promised this to the Great Reset overlords, who I can just imagine couldn't have been happier to hear about the magic of the modern monetary theory. End of the dollar. While MMTers attempt to paint their proposed monetary system as merely a more efficient way of managing the economy, it is in reality an incredibly risky experiment. And what happens if the experiment goes awry? As I mentioned earlier, modern monetary theorists try to soothe critics' concern about hyperinflation by saying even if the government bureaucrats and policymakers don't manage things perfectly in the future, the U.S. dollar's status as the world's reserve currency would protect Americans from hyperinflation and its nightmares. Well, okay, there is no question that the dollar's world reserve currency status would help at first. But who is going to say that the dollar would remain the global reserve currency in a universe in which the United States chose to embrace modern monetary theory? As recently as July 2020, Goldman Sachs warned that the dollar is increasingly at risk of losing its world reserve status. Strategist for Goldman specifically cited the Federal Reserve's swelling balance sheet and growing debt levels as the primary reasons for their worries. 242. If the United States were to aggressively travel further down the money printing road, as Stephanie Kelton and others have suggested, it is entirely possible and probably inevitable that other economic powerhouses like China would demand that their international commerce occur using alternate currencies like the euro or the Chinese yuan. Many government institutions and government leaders in Europe and Asia have already started floating the idea of shifting the reserve currency to the International Monetary Fund's Special Drawing Rights, SDR. SDR is essentially composed of a basket of currencies and designed to act as a stable medium of exchange for international trade. Quick side note, the International Monetary Fund is one of the biggest supporters of the Great Reset. I'm sure that, however, is just a coincidence. If the government and the Federal Reserve continue to pursue an MMT system, the U.S. dollar will become increasingly vulnerable to losing its world reserve currency status. This would likely cause the same hyperinflation that Kelton and others insist would never occur under their model, because countries would have no place to spend their greenbacks except in the United States, leading to an unprecedented flood of dollars returning to U.S. shores. This would drive prices in key industries like real estate and likely to send America into an economic depression that would far exceed coronavirus lockdown levels, as hard as that is for many to imagine. This scenario would be a truly horrifying economic nightmare, the likes of which this country has never seen before. It should give pause to everyone who has embraced or even flirted seriously with MMT and its reckless principles. Oh, and things could be even worse than the situation I just described. A special drawing rights model relying on a printed currency could end up being our best case scenario. Some influential economists and world leaders associated with the World Economic Forum are trying to dethrone the dollar by replacing it with a global digital currency. Now, consider what WEF board member Mark Carney, an economist and banker with an unquestionably impressive resume. Carney previously served as the governor of the Bank of Canada, as well as the governor of the Bank of England. He spends his days convincing other elites that the U.S. dollar is too influential in global markets and should be replaced with a digital currency. In his role as the governor of the Bank of England, Carney began to lay the groundwork out to give digital currencies greater standing with the bank and throughout the world. And at the 2019 Economic Policy Symposium at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, an annual conference attended by many of the world's central bankers, Carney touted the benefits of a new digital currency replacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Quote, a digital currency could dampen the domineering influence of the U.S. dollar on global trade, Carney said. The dollar's influence on global financial conditions could similarly decline if financial architecture developed around a new digital currency and displaced the dollar's dominance in credit markets, end quote. Carney is not alone. One of the biggest advocates for expanding the power of government-controlled digital currencies is the Chinese Communist Party. China is currently in the lead when it comes to creating the first digital currency backed by a large central bank. The digital yuan would allow the Chinese Communist Party to maintain unprecedented control over its country's finances. Chinese officials have already said they plan to use the digital yuan to better manage the economy and track and eliminate, quote, illegal transactions, which in China could be something as simple as going to a website the Communist Party doesn't like. And if China is doing it, you know the rest of the world's governing elites are paying attention, especially at the World Economic Forum, where influential Chinese citizens serve as board members. And in the latest conference for the Great Reset, President Xi was the keynote speaker. Given Carney and China's connections to the World Economic Forum, it should not surprise you to hear that WEF is already preparing to give their expert opinion on how to regulate government-controlled digital currencies, which many at WEF believe to be inevitable. In January 2020, the WEF announced the creation of the very first global consortium focused on designing a framework for governance of digital currencies, end quote. Speaking at the consortium in early 2020, WEF founder and executive chairman Klaus Schwab said, "We hope that hosting this consortium will catalyze the conversations necessary to inform a robust framework of governance for global digital currency." Yeah? Oh, boy. Even the Federal Reserve in the United States is now trying to get in on the fun. On February 28th, 2021, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said exploring the creation of a central bank digital currency is, quote, a high priority project for us, 250. Referring to the possibility of a digital currency, Powell added, this is going to be an important year. This is going to be the year in which we engage with the public pretty actively, end quote. And remember, the idea of an International Monetary Fund SDR system for the world reserve currency that I mentioned earlier in the chapter, it turns out that supporters are also considering pushing for a digital SDR currency. Back in 2019, during a Bank of England forum, Christine Lagarde, who was then the director of the IMF and is currently serving as president of the European Central Bank, discussed the idea of developing a digital version of SDR. This concept, dubbed IMF coin, could easily become the world's new reserve currency in a scenario, Lagarde said, is, quote, not a far-fetched hypothetical, end quote. The amount of power and control over the world that would come with the full embrace of an MMT system, especially if mixed with a digital currency, is almost too much to fathom. Dare I say, it's biblical. Not only would world government and central banks be able to create as much money as they wanted to, they could, depending on how the new monetary framework operates, create and distribute cash with a push of a button, literally. Quote, there's another round of angry riots in Paris over high energy costs. Put some of the newly minted digital cash into their digital wallets and politely tell them go home. Oh, we tried that and they aren't listening? Okay, empty their wallets then of all of their cash and see if that gets their attention. It's also worth considering how digital currencies would be used to control economic behavior. If all currency were to become digitized and physical mediums of exchange were phased out, then banks, financial institutions, governments would be able to track and control nearly every transaction in the world. Now, there is no way of knowing exactly how they might try to use this unprecedented power, but it's not hard to imagine how it could expand the authority of elites and impact regular people on a daily basis. We've all heard about local governments' attempts to tax and in some cases ban certain unhealthy foods, everything from foods containing trans fats to sugary drinks. In a world with a centralized digital currency, what's to stop the ruling class from putting a limit on the number of, I don't know, Cokes you buy each week, or the number of meat burgers you eat, or the number of alcoholic beverages you consume or cigars you smoke? What's to stop elites from preventing you from buying alcohol, cigarettes, Twinkies, the car you like? Because they're all bad for you or the collective. And what about limits on energy consumption? Perhaps you've done more than your fair share of traveling this year and deemed not important enough for a travel exemption. We can't have you polluting the planet on yet another unnecessary family vacation? I am confident the Second Amendment will survive the Great Reset, or at least on paper. It is incredibly difficult to change the Constitution, and there are too many states that would never agree to ratify an amendment that overturns the Second Amendment for gun rights to be stripped away in Congress. However, a Great Reset world that runs on a government-controlled global digital currency could make guns and ammunition sales virtually impossible. Powerful bankers and international institutions cannot make it illegal to ban guns in America, but they could stop people from buying or selling guns using their global currency, effectively killing most of the gun and ammunition industries. And if you think for a minute that Americans might be able to escape this sort of control because transactions occurring within our country might still continue to be made using U.S. dollars, remember the Federal Reserve is also strongly considering adopting its own digital currency. So whether it's the elites in Europe or China making the rules or elites at the Fed, the point is you will not be the one in control of your own economic decision making, at least that's the way things are currently shaping up. I could go on for days citing other potential problems that could arise from a centralized government-controlled digital currency, but I think you get the point. If international elites were to have authority over the world's digital currency, then they would have the power to control most of the global economic activity and, by extension, all human behavior. As the old saying goes, he who has the gold makes the rules. Or more accurately, but not quite as catchy, he who has the otherwise worthless digital currency everyone is required to accept as the only valid medium of exchange makes the rules. Now, at this point, you may be wondering, if modern monetary theory is an important component to the Great Reset, why are some elites at the World Economic Forum trying to undercut the dollar's position as the world's reserve currency? Why can't the ruling class just continue relying on the dollar, perhaps a digital dollar like the one Powell has alluded to? Unfortunately, all I can do at this point is speculate, but there are plenty of good justifications that ruling class elites might have for wanting to move on from the dollar. For starters, One of the biggest impediments to the globalist agenda over the past several decades has been the unwillingness of the United States to go along with internationalism. There have been many movements throughout modern history when globalists thought they had the world right where they wanted it, but then those darn Americans in their Scooby-Doo van got in the way. They did something unexpected, like elect Donald Trump as president. There is seemingly an endless amount of material I could point to showing that global elites view America's role in the world as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, impediments to ushering in the Great Reset, like alterations to the international economy. But some of the best evidence comes by way of George Soros, one of the most influential voices in the globalist movement. Since the 1980s, Soros and his Open Society Foundations, one of the wealthiest philanthropic organizations on the planet, have spent more than $14 billion on a variety of causes in more than 100 countries. Leaked documents from Soros's Open Society Foundation show it is, quote, clearly devoted to the eradication, is, quote, clearly devoted to the eradication of national sovereignty, end quote, and using a crisis to advance its political and social goals. The elimination of national sovereignty is Soros's guiding principle, one that has helped shape most of his political and philanthropic work. In an article for The Guardian by Daniel Bessner, a professor at the University of Washington and contributing editor for the popular socialist magazine Jacobin, Bessner correctly notes that in Soros's mind, quote, the two major threats to an open society are capitalistic hyper-globalization and market fundamentalism, end quote. He explains, Soros argued that the history of the post-Cold War world, as well as his personal experiences as one of international finance's most successful traders, demonstrated that unregulated global capitalism undermined open society in three distinctive ways. First, because capital could move anywhere to avoid taxation. Western nations were deprived of the finances they needed to provide citizens with public goods. Second, because international lenders were not subject to much regulation, they often engaged in unsound lending practices that threatened financial stability. Finally, because these realities increased domestic and international inequality. Soros feared they would encourage people to commit unspecified acts of desperation that could damage the global system's viability. End quote. For Soros, the only way to address these and other related perceived problems is to establish a new global system of political decision-making. Footnote 257. Wow, this really kind of sounds an awful lot like the Great Reset, doesn't it? But I'm sure it's just another coincidence. However, Soros has continuously identified one gigantic roadblock standing in the way of his dream of advancing the cause of internationalism, and that, as stated by him, is America. Bessner explains that, quote, as early as 1998, Soros acknowledged that the U.S. was the primary opponent of global institutions by this point in time. Americans had refused to join the International Court of Justice, had declined to sign the Ottawa Treaty on banning landmines, and had unilaterally imposed economic sanctions where and when they saw fit, end quote. Soros spelled this belief out clearly in his 2007 book, The Age of Fallibility, which, by the way, is agonizingly boring. Quote, the main obstacle, well, let me do it like him. The main obstacle to stable and just world order is United States. This is harsh indeed, even for me, painful thing to say. But unfortunately, I am convinced that it is true. United States continues to set agenda for world in spite of its loss of influence since 9/11 and Bush administration setting up wrong agenda. Bush agenda nationalistic. It emphasizes use of force. Ignores global problems whose solution requires international cooperation. I know he's not really Russian, but he kind of sounds better as a Russian, doesn't he? Soros's views are pervasive in international circles of influence. So is it really surprising that many globalists are keen on pushing the dollar out of its position of prominence? Would they really want to trust control of the lifeblood of their Great Reset system to a currency operating under MMT principles? To a country with strong independent streak like the United States? No, I highly doubt it. From their perspective, it would be much better if the international ruling class had its own currency, preferably one that was easy for elites to manage, and one where a guy like Donald Trump isn't certainly suddenly in control. What could possibly be easier than to control a digital currency? MMT success stories. Modern monetary theorists are often confronted by skeptics concerned about the elites gambling with America's future on a largely unproven economic theory. When that happens, Kelton and other supporters of MMT usually respond by arguing that many of their ideas have actually been tried before, and with great success, in the mysterious ancient land of Japan. The following argument by Kelton is just one example out of many showing how modern monetary theorists usually present this important claim. Quote, "So it's impossible, really, to put a number. I mean, no one can. How much debt is too much debt? Well, if you look at Japan today, you'll see a country where the debt-to-GDP ratio is something like 240%, well above, orders of magnitude above, where the U.S. is today, or even where the U.S. is forecast to be in the future. And so the question is, how is Japan able to sustain a debt of that size? Wouldn't it have an inflation problem? Wouldn't it lead to rising interest rates? Wouldn't this be destructive in some way? And the answer to all of those questions, as Japan has demonstrated now for years, is simply no. Japan's debt is close to 240% of GDP, almost a quadrillion. That's a big number in yen. Long-term interest rates are very close to zero. There's no inflation, and so despite the size of the debt, there are no negative consequences as a result, and I think Japan teaches us a really important lesson," end quote. All right, before I address Kelton's argument here, take a minute to marvel at her assertion. A 240% debt-to-GDP ratio is completely acceptable. If translated to America, that amount would be a national debt of more than $51 trillion. Okay? That is more money than all of the money on Earth currently in circulation, paper and digital, all of the money from around the world combined. You know what that means? Ponies for everybody. Uncle Sam is picking up the tab. Now, I admit that Kelton is correct in asserting that Japan has yet to suffer through high levels of inflation, even though it has amassed a staggering level of debt. However, as with everything else in life, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Japan is far from the MMT utopia that Kelton would have you believe. Although Japan's government has spent trillions on construction-related public investment over the past three decades, precisely the type of spending that MMTers propose, economic growth has almost totally stagnated. Japan's problems began long before the coronavirus pandemic hit. From 1995 to 2018, Japan's GDP decreased by more than 8%. Over the same time period, the United States has experienced 168% growth in GDP. Further, in Japan, the percentage of the GDP composed of government spending has also steadily increased over the last two decades, showing that substantially more economic power has to be vested in the hands of the Japanese government over that period. So now with this in mind, should Americans really consider Japan an MMT success story? It is an anemic economy, massive amounts of debt, and increased size of government, something most Americans pine for? I am no mind reader, but I hope to say that it is still safe to bet that when faced with these facts, most people in the United States would want nothing to do with modern monetary theory. MMT in America. When I first heard about the concept of modern monetary theory, I probably, like you, thought it was nothing more than yet another delusional fantasy concocted by ivory tower elites that had as much of a chance to become a reality as I have of winning a gold medal for figure skating at the next Olympics. Which, just to be clear, I'm not an exactly graceful ice skater, but I can kneecap people. If 2020 taught us anything, it is that the groundwork for a large-scale shift to modern monetary theory has already been laid, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic. The United States appears to be on the MMT train at this very moment, even though most Americans still haven't even heard of the concept. In the aftermath of the Great Recession of 2008, politicians began constructing a plan to stimulate the economy. Competing plans outlined ways to get people back to work and stabilize markets. After much negotiating between reckless politicians in the Republican and Democratic parties, President Obama signed into law the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, a price that at the time we all thought was crazy, $830 billion. At that time, we chastised Obama for being fiscally reckless, while liberals celebrated Obama for taking bold action to save the economy. However, in 2019 and 2020, MMTers like Kelton called Obama basically a conservative when it came to fiscal policy, and congressional Republicans and their Republican president passed legislation in a single year that added more money to the national debt than nearly every other president in history did during their full terms in office. This proves that modern monetary theory has already moved from being a fringe concept supported by a small band of mostly unknown academics to a mainstream practice embraced by politicians, both in the GOP and the Democratic Party. Additionally, some of MMT's biggest names have risen to the highest rungs of power in America. As I mentioned earlier in the chapter, Kelton served as the chief economist for the Democratic Party staff on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee and as a key economic advisor to Bernie Sanders during his 2016-2020 presidential election. And Kelton also served on Joe Biden's 2020 Unity Task Force, where she heavily influenced Biden's platform and first-year policies. Just a decade ago, MMT academics like Kelton were being laughed out of the room. Today, they are advising presidents and congressional budget committees, and the popularity of modern monetary theory is likely to grow within the academic community in the years to come, especially in the wake of George Soros' sudden and strange infatuation with small liberal arts colleges in upstate New York. At a January 2020 speech before the, you guessed it, World Economic Forum, Soros announced that he was launching a new kind of global educational network to, quote, advance the values of an open society, including Soros's commitment to internationalism, footnote 266. Soros pledged $1 billion to the new association, which he named the Open Society University Network. Increasingly, the two colleges leading the network are Central European University, a graduate college in Vienna, founded by Soros, and Bard College, a small liberal arts school in the United States that enrolls around 2,200 undergraduate students. Soros also named in 2020 the president of Bard College, Leon Botstein, as the Open Society University Network's first chancellor. This is a position Botstein had filled while continuing to serve as Bard's president. Even more remarkably, less than 7 months after Soros announced the creation of the Open Society University Network, his Open Society Foundations agreed to give Bard $100 million. Wow, he sure loves the Bard College. If Bard sounds familiar to you, it's because of earlier in the chapter, I mentioned it when discussing L. Randall Ray and Pavlina Cherneva, two of the world's leading modern monetary theory economists, both of whom work as influential professors at the Bard College. Bard is also the home to the Levy Economic Institute, the epicenter of modern monetary theory scholarship. So not only does the Levy Economic Institute feature the work of Ray, Cherneva, and other MMT academics and organize the international conferences on modern monetary theory, but it also counts as one of its researchers, the queen of modern monetary theory, Stephanie Kelton. Now, I suppose it's all just a coincidence that George Soros chose to make Bard College the mecca of modern monetary theory movement, the leading institution in Soros's new $1 billion global education network. I suppose it is also possible that there is some special reason not related to MMT that Soros has decided to give the college $100 million to name as its president the chancellor of his new international network. But in my experience, when it comes to Mr. Soros, there is no such thing as coincidence. I cannot prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, of course, but I am willing to bet that the reason Soros is building his new educational network around Bard College is because of the small school's devotion to modern monetary theory, and because Soros knows that if modern monetary theory were to be fully embraced by leading U.S. institutions, it would inevitably push the entire world towards a more centralized governing structure, one that would give powerful elites control over nearly every economic decision, either directly or indirectly. And that is the goal that Soros has been working towards for decades. And with modern monetary theory systems fully in place, he, as well as supporters of the Great Reset, know it could finally become a reality. Fueling the machine. Like the elite's plan to create the Federal Reserve System more than 100 years ago, embracing MMT will probably start with a meeting of the country's most powerful government officials, bankers, and business people who will travel from every corner of the globe to devise a plan to reset the world economic system. And when they do, I am sure they will erroneously assure the American people that creating trillions of dollars out of thin air and disregarding the national debt would open the door to a new era of economic growth. Thanks to this book, you will know why you should not trust them. And thanks to this book, if you see Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, or Stephanie Kelton dressed as duck hunters boarding a train in the middle of the night, you'll know what's going on. The Great Reset is a machine manufactured to usher in a new, highly sophisticated, technologically advanced 21st century brand of international fascism, one with a corporatist twist. But powerful machines like the Great Reset cannot operate without fuel. That is what modern monetary theory provides. By offering seemingly endless amounts of money that can be used as fuel to pay for just about anything the government, corporations, or financial institutions can dream up, it continues to chug on. COVID-19 created the conditions for the machine's existence. Without an urgent global crisis that could normalize modern monetary theory and burn down well-established economic and societal norms, the world would never have allowed the Great Reset to emerge as a viable option. People like Greta Thunberg would have screamed and shouted and shamed all day long, but it never would have resulted in the progress she wanted because everyone else in society had way too much to lose. But as important as COVID-19 has been for the Great Reset, it is climate change that provides the key, the long-term justification for far-reaching, sustained transformation of society. Without a decades-long existential crisis for governments and business leaders to rally around, the coronavirus pandemic would be nothing more than a fleeting public policy challenge, a larger one, no doubt, but temporary, and thus not useful for the sort of grand structural changes dreamt up by the Great Reset's leaders. It is climate change policies, fueled by modern monetary theory, that ultimately provide the foundation upon which everything can be built for the New World Order, that Greenpeace's Jennifer Morgan alluded to in her Great Reset presentation before the World Economic Forum in mid-2020. But what exactly does that new world look like? That is the topic of the next chapter, The Great Reset, Building a 21st Century Fascism Machine.